He's getting there.
Oh, man.
He said, like, fifth cousin twice over.
Once or twice removed.
Steve said, I did. No, very big. But yeah.
Penny says that.
Penny also says, hello. Are all of us kind of sinusy and sniffly and coughing? Besides Steve?
I am.
Everybody's got it?
Everybody's got it.
Did the weather event finally winter in Charleston?
No, it's so close.
Yeah, that all the pollen that we've had already.
My car was covered.
That was me. Thank you for the car wash.
We don't generally have flowers in February.
Yeah, flowers in February.
Oh, good.
Chill.
With Mitch Ford. Four with a long chapter. For those that are visiting with us, we are doing a study of Francis Chan's book called Crazy Love. It's not from Mr. Price Guy. We have been looking at it. Penny is thrilled.
Absolutely.
More. Yeah. The whole point of this book is the idea of our response to God and His grace. What is appropriate, what's inappropriate, what's the most common way we see love to God expressed in the American church going experience. And if you haven't caught the speed yet, Chan thinks there's a lot of room for improvement when it comes to our zeal towards God, and not only just showing up, but also doing all that we can to be disciples of Christ. Chapter 5, I think, is probably the most telling chapter to kind of show you what Chan thinks when it comes to what the point of this book really is. The title of this chapter is Serving Leftovers to a Holy God. You can kind of get a feel for that throughout this entire chapter. I've got some things I want to say about his responses. I want to get your input as well. Is Eric here?
He's in the back.
Okay. He's got a question he sent to me 2 weeks ago, thinking that we were in chapter 5. So I wanted him to ask his question to all of us. I think his question is a very good one. So when he gets here, I'll pick on it for that. Okay, so chapter 5. He says, of all the chapters in the book, this is the hardest for me to write. I do not wish for my words to come across as controversial or difficult to swallow. Because the chapter, you know where you're going. But I had to write this chapter because I believe what I'm about to talk about is important and true. So this whole concept of looking at God thus far, chapter 1 was about the idea of breaking down who God really is. So when you go to God in prayer, stop for a second and remember to whom you're speaking. And then basically the rest of the book up until this point has been kind of a diagnostic view of what the normal church-going experience is like and how different that is than what the Bible talks about. Eric, I'm talking about when I have you ask the question you sent me 2 weeks ago. I want to have you ask the question you asked me 2 weeks ago, if you can recall it.
Put me on the spot.
Just a little bit. You can scroll up to that text thread and we'll figure it out. So that's Chan's point for this entire book. Basically, is don't give him the leftovers. He demands your best. He's going to use various arguments and thoughts to kind of lead us down that path. But that's basically the conclusion of chapter 5. So this next block we have here. My examination of lukewarm Christians in chapter 4 was by no means exhaustive. I mentioned that he's painting with a broad brush, that he is not really trying to narrow down your experience, but here's his intent. However, it did serve as a call to examine your heart in light of the points I listed. So that was why we had, 3 weeks in chapter 4, is he's giving us all these symptoms, basically. If you look like this as opposed to this, maybe you're lukewarm, right? So that's the idea of not giving your full attention, your full thought, your whole heart to God when it comes to being in Christ. And then this is kind of telling for someone not in the church. It's telling about this particular thought. As I see it, a lukewarm Christian is an oxymoron. There is no such thing. To put it plainly, churchgoers who are lukewarm are not Christians. We will not see them in heaven. How often do you read someone who's not in the brotherhood, per se, and talks about people not going to heaven?
Not real.
It's not very often for me. I read a lot of folks that are ample grace. They're saying, hey, look, it's not my place to judge, and God's grace covers all, and I'm not going to say who's in the book of life or not. But he's pretty clear about this position here, and that is telling as to why he's so motivated to write this book. Right? If you got a guy who believes people are not going to go to heaven if they don't do what Jesus told them to do, that gives him a little bit of fire to talk about what we should be doing instead, right? What are your thoughts about that? Are lukewarm Christians going to heaven? I guess we'll just start with the big question.
Well, Christ said no. He said, I'd rather you be either cold or what, and because you're not, I'll spew you out of my mouth.
Yeah.
That tells me they're not.
So they're in the body, right?
Right.
Something has to be in your body to be spewed out, which is a very polite way to say the actual Greek there. A bit more graphic in the Greek. Only using this one verse, by the way, in the entire New Testament. You get the picture. So they're in the body, and he said, I'm going to spew you out, right? So he says the exact same thing because he goes back to Revelation 3, 15 through 18, which we've read, and talks about how they are neither hot nor cold, and he tells them to go and repent, to change, and then to buy gold refined in fire from him, to buy these spotless garments, and to cover their nakedness.
I guess it'll be up to God to determine those who are lukewarm. Because probably most of them that are lukewarm don't feel like they're lukewarm.
Yeah, that's true. I had someone text me this week, and they say they're reading through the chapters, and they say, do you think that we're lukewarm as a church? I think, well, James would think so. I think, well, he's not the judge. I was like, of course he's not the judge. He's just a guy, right? So Christ is the judge. Are we all lukewarm? In some ways. At times, yeah. But generally here, the whole point is not to guilt trip about this, right? The whole point is not to say, look how bad we're doing. But it's to examine where we are and to think about what we can do to improve and then make those changes that necessary to the scriptures, right? That's the whole point of why we're doing this. Jim?
What encourages me, though, is in the letter to the Sardis, he had all kinds of problems with him, and yet he said, there are some of you that are blameless and shall walk with me in glory. So it's an individual thing. And, you know, you could have 1,000 people here and 999 of them be lukewarm and you not be. So it's an individual thing. So we got to work out our own salvation with fear and trembling and not be lukewarm.
That's right. Absolutely. It's individual. But the influence of others is definitely there. If it's comfortable and everybody's doing the same thing, it's easy to go with the flow, then it is to say, well, no, there's some things we can do to change. So it's kind of... Yes, it's individual, but...
So you need to be careful who you hang around with.
I guess that's the point, right? High school.
What about people that go to different churches? They have different beliefs, but they still believe in God. Are they going to heaven?
If they obey the scriptures, they are. The only congregations, or any groups that I've seen that teach the Bible plainly and clearly without any addition of creeds is the church. They're... are other groups that are very, very, very close, but there are big differences as well. Okay, anything else? I'm glad you guys are talking to my friend. It's going to get out by 1 o'clock. So, okay, let's change position. All right, let's jump forward just a little bit here. He says, in an early, this is not about this chapter. I wanted to highlight this because I wanted to talk about this concept. In an earlier draft of this chapter, I quoted several commentators who agreed with my point of view. But we all know that you can find quotes to support any view you want to take, which is interesting to me that he would put that in his book. You can even tweak word studies to help you in your effort, which is true. I'm not against scholarship, but I do believe there are times when we come to more accurate conclusion through simple reading. What do you think about that statement?
I see it every day.
You see it every day? In what way?
Take, for example, the endless political discussions that occur on social media. It's almost like a game. Find the founding father whose words you can twist to your point of view.
Okay.
Constantly.
Politics.
Yeah.
How do we always end up coming back to politics? Why do God put us here in that direction?
Because I made the hard move go.
Listen, Tom. All right. What else do you guys think about this quote? I think it's an interesting point of view. So most of you know that I've gone back to college, right, to finish out my degree. I got a preaching certificate from a 2-year preaching school, and then you want to get more education, so I come to college and I'm going to do that for me. And I learned a lot. I have learned a lot. I value it very much, and I paid for that value, and I appreciate that. But it's interesting that the more you go into a scholarship position when it comes to the Bible, the more faith you have to have. Because anyone that you read when it comes to the actual textual quality of what we're reading, there are some gaps, there are some holes, there are some debates, there are some disputes, there's some translation error. So just the more technical you get, the more faith you have to have that the Lord is giving you the document that you're reading now, and that it's trustworthy and reliable. That's kind of almost a joke at this point. It's interesting that when you go into a textual criticism class, when they say, who is the author of, let's say, the first 5 books of the Bible, what would you say?
Moses
wrote the first 5 books of Moses, right? If you go into a class like that, they're going to say, prove it. And by the way, you can't. You really can't prove that Moses wrote the first 5 books. You can prove maybe he wrote parts of it, but you can't prove that he wrote it. So who wrote 1 Corinthians?
Paul.
We say Paul. Can you prove it? I can. I tried really, really hard. That was my thesis. I tried really, really hard. So you can get close, but you can't say with 100% certainty Paul wrote it. Who wrote 1 Peter and 2 Peter for that matter? Who would say Peter? But most scholars of that degree say someone that was following Peter or his doctrine, his teaching, is a student of Peter, wrote 2 Peter, for example. So my point is, yes, I think it's significant to know about scholarly stuff, to be able to go down that rabbit hole, to learn information, to be critical, look at it with an objective viewpoint. At the same time, if you just read the material, that's the material that changed your life. That's the gospel. That's how it's taught to you. And so you can go as deep as you want, but don't lose sight of the forest or the trees, right? As the saying goes, I think. Eric?
What's the value, though, in trying to prove who the author of those things is? Because of 2 reasons. One, we are called to believe that all of it is spiritually inspired. And 2, we're also called to take it on faith.
So, yeah. I think the point
I don't need proof.
Is you have other documents that are out there that claim to be written by important people. And if you can tell this is genuine and this is disgenuine, is it the age, the dating, the place it was written from, and so on, you're able to actually verify that the books that we have, these 66, these are breathed out by God. The other ones are fake. And if you're not able to go down that and see the differences, it can be a little scary because the other books, which there are plenty of them that are fake, they've got some wild stuff in there. And that will change our faith completely if we were to let one of those books in. So that's kind of...
I think a bunch of people in Utah went down that road.
When I look at faith, I understand how important it is. And when I look at proving the Bible, I look at things like archaeology. There was a name, and I don't remember what it was, in the Bible that nobody had ever heard of. And then somewhere over in Iraq, whatever, they dug up a plate that had this person's name on it. Those things, to me, proved the accuracy of the Bible. Yeah. And that's what I don't believe anybody knows anything about God except through the Bible.
Yeah. Well, the name Hittite was back in the 80s. They said Hittites never existed.
And the prophecy, how accurate it is.
So I'm not going into a general biblical introduction class. I'm just saying I thought it was interesting that Chan put in here. I could quote a bunch of people, but we can all do that. And so if you just read it simplistically, you get the point. And we tried to do that in Mark, remember, a couple of months ago? We went through Mark kind of systematically, the shortest gospel account. We tried to pretend like we've never read it before. So we were in the first century, we're a second generation Christian, we're going to read this book and figure out what we learn about Jesus, right? That was kind of the point. So that's what he's talking about doing here, is if you just kind of forget what you think you know about Christianity by your church-going experience and just read the Bible, how different are those two things? Going to church, doing Christian things, versus what being a disciple of Jesus is in the Scriptures. So that's kind of a point to make. He says, let's face it, we're willing to make changes in our own life and in our lives only if we think it affects our salvation. Is that true?
For a lot of people.
What's that?
For a lot of people.
For a lot of people. Very safe answers, guys. This is why I have so many people ask me questions like, can I divorce my wife and still go to heaven? I'm thankful I've never been asked that question. I can't even get to this without crack a smile. Do I have to be baptized to be saved? Well, the first thing we did was watch a sermon that he preached about that question. Do you have to be baptized to be saved? What was the answer?
Yes,
you do. Now, am I a Christian even though I'm having sex with my girlfriend?
No.
Well,
could be an erring Christian.
Well, all right, that was a pretty quick joke there. You can be a Christian and live in sin, right? Or commit sin, at the very least. If I commit suicide, can I still go to heaven? I'm not asking you to say yes or no to these folks. I'm just saying these kind of questions you're being asked. It's interesting because I've been asked all of these. If I'm ashamed to talk about Christ, is he really going to deny knowing me?
Says he will.
Okay. To me, these questions are tragic because they reveal much about the state of our hearts. They demonstrate that our concern is more about going to heaven than loving the King. Right? We talked about that before. In a different way, basically. Do we want to do enough to avoid hell? Or do you want to love God and be with Him forever? That's two different things, right? Then we came to the conclusion that, yeah, you start out with fear, I want to go to hell, and eventually you mature, and you grow into a point where you want to love God, right? And you actually do. That's kind of a progression that you can see. So, that's his introduction, this concept. Jump forward a little bit. Each of us has lukewarm elements and practices in our life. Therein lies the senseless, extravagant grace of it all. But he's saying nobody's perfect, which is good. Because so far, Chan's standard seems to be a little high, to say the very least. I wish Jason was here, because he was talking to me about, do you think we all could be like friends with Chan and go to heaven? And the answer is obviously not. Right? If we're all have to be what Chan had done, talks about, then he would be our standard and not God's will, which is, of course, the point. But reading the human author with a different perspective can definitely help us see something a little differently. Okay, so the scriptures demonstrate clearly that there is room for our failure and sin in our pursuit to God. His mercies are new every morning, His grace is sufficient. I'm not saying that when you mess up, it means that you never really were a genuine Christian in the first place. If that were true, no one could follow Christ. What do you think about that statement?
Well, I think 1 John tells us that.
Yeah.
You know, we see that 1 John, that if we fall, we have the blood of Christ. If we walk in the light as He is in the light, which is an unweird approach to making it to a destination, that we will be forgiven.
Yeah. I've shared my struggle with the idea of identity when it comes to sin, right from 1 John. So I got to walk in the light. This is driving me crazy.
That's the philosophy that some of the denominations use for the once saved, always saved.
Yeah.
You never were a Christian if you... That's...
Yeah. The idea of walking in the light. So as long as you don't sin, you're walking in the light. And then as soon as you sin, you're walking in darkness. And so you better get bounced back and forth between the light and the darkness. And you better make sure you're on the right side before you die. That's not Christianity. No. Right? That's rule-keeping, basically. As soon as you break a rule, then you're lost. That's not what Jesus offers. He offers abundant life, right? Grace, mercy, forgiveness. Now, when you walk away from Christ and you live in sin and live in darkness in a perpetual state, that's a whole different thing. But do you know the folks that have just walked away from Christianity entirely?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, is that different than someone who messes up and is fallible?
Yeah, sure it is.
Yeah, big difference.
Well, James says, when you bring forth sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. So John tells us we're a sin. If we say we don't sin, we're a liar.
Yeah. So that's what he's talking about here.
The important part is the repenting and keeping in the blood.
The walking in the light is an active verb, right? Here.
I think one of the hardest things for people to do is forgive themselves and move on. A lot of times they think about their past or what they've done. They think that, you know, you're done. There's nothing I can do. I've gone too far or what have you. They don't forgive themselves. You have to forgive yourself. Pick up your bootstraps, as they say, and get back in the straight walk.
Paul talked about the idea of doing one thing well. Forgetting those things that are behind and pressing forward those things that are before. What did he have to leave behind?
Oh, he had a history.
He had a bunch.
Tell the murder Christians?
Right.
His own family of God that are on it? Yeah. You know how hard it is to forgive the fact that you brought someone to court and they stoned these people to death and you were happy because of it? Because you thought you were doing your job for God and all of a sudden Christ shows up and says, "Are good things the goats. We're trying to lead you down the road for a while." So, yes. So, it's important for us to know that when you read this book, Shane is not trying to say, do a guilt trip, make sure you all do better. He's not trying to say to attain perfection. What he is saying, I think is important, is that we can all do a little bit better when it comes to the idea of giving more. Not just our time or money, but our heart to God. For discipleship. So, poor rich people, the story here about two folks and about how blessed we are. I'm not going to slow down for that. Does anyone have any doubt that we are in the richest economy in the world of all time, basically?
It's that way.
Okay. There are some historical civilizations that were wealthy, obviously. In Solomon's day, they were kicking down gold like it was nothing. But overall, our quality of life in this generation. This economy, this culture, is the best it's ever been, as far as we're aware. We're incredibly blessed. And he kind of goes into a point here about the idea of we are so blessed. Make sure you don't just throw your bones at God, right? As long as your bones have more meat than the person next to you, think you're doing well, that's not the standard. That's not the biblical way to look at that. So when talking to a wealthy person, this is hallelujah, because I wanted to see the dichotomy here. When talking to a wealthy person who wanted to go to heaven, to the rich young ruler, Jesus said, "Sell everything you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come, follow me." And when he, the rich man, heard this, he became very sad because he was a man of great wealth. Jesus looked at him and said, "How hard is it for the rich to enter the kingdom of God? It's hard as a camel to go through the eye of a needle." In other words, impossible. I've heard a couple of things about the idea of the camel going through the eye of a needle. I've heard, it's actually a translation problem, talking about it, a person riding on a camel going through a city gate. Okay, so they have to lower themselves. It sounds great, but it's all made up, so it's not real. The real thing is actually real. In other words, possible. And then he offers in verse 27 a hopeful words, "What is impossible with man is possible with God." Now, I love this next connection that I've never made before. In the very next chapter, as Jesus enters Jericho, we see exactly how the impossible becomes possible with God. There is a wealthy tax collector, guy of short stature, right? He gives half of his winnings to the poor and pays everyone back four times what he has departed them. And Jesus declares, "Today salvation has come to this house." So that connection of, you know, rich young ruler and then a man who is wealthy, he's a publican, tax collector, but he's actually not done it by fraud, he's actually done it well. It's interesting to see that connection. Gary?
Seems as though we have a problem in the country that a lot of people are jealous of the wealthy. which I've never been. If a man goes out and makes his money, that's his business. But he is responsible, just as I am, to contribute to the Lord, no matter how rich he is.
Yeah.
You know? It seems as though in this nation we're definitely having a problem with people being jealous over people who make their money and are rich.
Sure. Any questions, comments?
I have a problem with some of the wealthy bankers that just gave $10 billion to combat climate change.
Yeah.
Has he thought about helping his fellow man?
Let me call him. Talk about it. We'll see if we can get through there. Okay. It is easy to fill ourselves up with other things and then give God whatever is left. Okay. That is a little hope, a little bit. Hosea 13:6, or say that, or whatever you say. When I fed them, they were satisfied. When they were satisfied, they became proud, and then they forgot me. That true for the Israelites?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
From Joshua's day, the judges, and all that?
All of it. But you get to the very end of Joshua, and they did what God told them to do, kind of. But make sure you cast out all the people that are there, so that God's going to be born on your side. And they did, for the most part. Kept a couple back. And then they showed back up. And then they grew. And they served them in judges. It's just a terrible cycle that they went through, right? And before that, they were traveling, wandering, living on the food that God gave them from heaven, the water from the rock. They were completely dependent on God. And when they got to a land where they were comfortable, God didn't matter as much because they had what they needed. And that's basically the point I think that Chan's trying to make here, is that we are living with God in the forefront of our minds, fully dependent under Him. That's a different state than saying, well, I've got all the stuff and I'll add God to the equation. Right? That's a whole different thing. Okay, questions, comments?
But thanks.
Yeah.
The things we are blessed with, if we're not careful, they can pull us away from God, in a sense.
Yeah.
We've got so much going on in our lives, so much things we have to take care of, so many things we have to do, then our time for God is limited. So we have to, it's kind of a balance we have to.
Yeah, that's what it is. And the conversation helps us remember that balance. It's easy to kind of slip into the mode of just taking care of day-to-day stuff, and it becomes week-to-week stuff, month-to-month stuff, and then get stuck into that cycle. We don't step back every now and again and remember there's that balance between making sure God's a priority, other stuff's important as well, and then making sure we balance that properly. That's the issue. I've got a problem with using Malachi for this. I know what he's trying to do. So in Malachi, this is the last book written in the canon that's inspired before Matthew, right? What's the state of Israel? Not good. Because they've got some issues. And one of the big issues was the way that they were going through sacrifices and offerings was inappropriate. In fact, Malachi is the book that says that it's evil, they should stop doing it, and that God hates their feast days. The thing that he made for them to celebrate their history of God giving them salvation, because I hate them, because they were offering things that were polluted, things that were corrupt. And they were doing it with no heart. So he's saying it's better to not do it at all than do it with the wrong intention. But he does the thing here. He does the thing, which I don't like, personally. This is a personal pet peeve. This is not a Bible position. It's just a thing I have a hard time with. He does the thing where in chapter 3 he talks about the idea of putting God to the test, right? I get the point. Putting God to the test by giving your best and see how much God will give you in return. But if I had a dollar for every time someone said, send me your seed money, give me all the money you have to God, and I will make sure that God blesses you abundantly. And that just preys on people that are at home listening to that televangelist say that stuff. It really bothers me to say that in that context. The original context was for the people of Malachi's day to come back to great faith in God. So in this one opportunity, God says, okay, you want to test me? Go ahead and test me this way. Give me your best, people of Malachi's day, and see what happens. They are going to be blessed abundantly. And that's in fact what happened historically. They were blessed abundantly. And then the Maccabean Rebellion happens, and things kind of went down real quick. But that was for them. And so for Chan to pull it out of its context and apply it to us, if we give all the money in our wallet this morning, see how God's going to bless you tomorrow morning. I get the point, but it's just the wrong way to do it, I think. That's the personal thing. What are your thoughts?
God owns it all anyway.
Yeah.
And we don't give because God needs it. We give for our benefit. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein.
If any were here, I'll speak for him. It's Najon's train of thought. If any were here, he would no doubt quote the idea from Philippians that he learned to be content in all things, right?
Right.
But he was thankful for the gift. It's the most polite way to say, thanks for the cash. It really helped me out. Because I'm in chains in this house, I have to pay for myself, thanks Rome, while I write the New Testament for you. He's thankful for the gift, but he's more thankful for the fruit that would abound
to their account.
Yeah, so it's like, yeah, thank you for meeting my needs, but I'm more thankful that you have the opportunity to use the wealth that God gave you to support me, because by doing that, God sees your heart as a sweet smelling sacrifice, if you will, that aroma is there. It's going to be blessing you even more. And so using the tools that God gave us in a wise manner that glorifies God in the first place is the most important thing that we can do. And that's the intent, I think, of what Chan's trying to say here, is to use your tools wisely, but the way he goes about it, I'm not that big of a fan, personally. Okay. Jesus' instruction to the people of the church at Laodicea was to buy from him the things that really matter. The things they didn't even realize they needed. They were wealthy, but Jesus asked them to exchange their wealth for his gold that's refined through fire, which is, by the way, the most revelation way ever to talk about going through tribulation and persecution. They had clothing, but Christ counsels them to buy clothes that were truly white and would cover their nakedness. They didn't desire anything, but Jesus said they needed salve for their eyes, that they would cure their blindness. Which, by the way, who had some cure blindness? He gives them to give up what they thought was so necessary and valuable in exchange for matters. This little text block here tells me a little story about the idea of what we think we need versus what God said we need. Is there a difference between sometimes what we think we need, or maybe even want, and what God says we need?
Absolutely.
What do we need?
Food, clothing, and shelter.
Okay. Give us this day
our daily bread.
Our daily bread, right? I love the fact that daily is in there for us. Give us this day our daily bread. So tomorrow happens, we can pray again. Give us this day our daily bread. Next day, guess what? Same thing. So you're living one day at a time, right?
Yeah, because you know nobody's guaranteed tomorrow.
Preacher's tape, right here.
Like in chapter 2, when he said you might die before finishing this chapter.
That's right. Those were kind of thought about this one. Yeah, so the idea of perspective of what we really need versus what we really want in life can be very, very important here. We learned that in kind of a side note from Revelation, right? Let us say and thought they were okay. Everything's good. God says, yeah, you got some stuff, but it's not the right stuff. That's interesting to put it that way. Let's talk about potato chips. Okay, recently I saw a bag of potato chips with a bold declaration splashed across the front. 0 grams of trans fat. That's a good tasting word, right? Right. I was glad to know that I wouldn't be consuming any trans fat, which research has shown is detrimental to my health. When I flipped the bag over and read the ingredient list, it was things like yellow number 6, which is the best one, of course, and other artificial colors, partially hydrogenated, which is trans fat, just small enough amount that they can legally claim it's 0 grams, which is pretty clever, right? 0 grams. Well, it's, you know, 0.77 grams, but it's not really 1 gram. So there you go. So the point was, from this particular story, that Christians sometimes flash that label of 0 grams trans fat and have a "I'm living a holy lifestyle." But what's really in there is not quite as genuine as in here, right? Is there a healthy potato chip out there?
Absolutely.
Is it?
Ruffles.
Ruffles? They have Ridges, right?
Yes.
If you read labels, you won't eat anything. I pray before I eat.
I always love the prayer before we actually have healthy fellowship meals. And I'll say, bless this food for the nourishment of our body. I'm going to get so much gravy, it's going to nourish me. This holy What's the only holy fast food around here? You know?
Chick-fil-A.
Amen, Chick-fil-A. So pray with me if you want to. So
good. Can we back up?
I could.
A little more. Right before the potato chips.
Oh, yeah.
Right there.
Yeah.
Third line from the top.
Mark Buchanan writes, whoever that is, "Physical sickness we usually defy. Soul sickness we often resign ourselves to."
I highlighted that one.
Yeah, like that one. So being physically sick, what are you going to do about it? If you're a responsible human being, and not just any typical male, you're physically sick, what are you going to do?
Seek help. You want to seek help.
Call Nancy. That's exactly what I do. Nancy, what's going on? Is it serious? No. So yeah, we physically sick, we're going to try to get it fixed, right, if possible. Soul sickness, we resign ourselves to. Well, that's the way I'm doing. That's who I am. So many stories. Okay, let's finish up this. Well, he does a thing that I didn't know that I could borrow. So my very first ever tryout sermon here, I know you won't remember, it was on 1 Corinthians. It was chapter 13. And I did the thing he did here. I didn't know it was stolen. But here's the thing he did. I was challenged to do a little exercise with these verses, one that profoundly convicted and also a great sermon trick. Take the phrase, "Love is patient," and substitute your name for the word love. So for him, Francis, so Alan is patient, and do it for every phrase and passage. By the end, don't you feel like a liar?
Like,
well, March, Jan. You know, a liar. I got like at least three of those. Love, Alan's patient. Alan's kind.
I get thrown off on the first one.
So kind of, so for the rest.
Derailed.
Yeah. So anyway, following Christ isn't something that can be done half-heartedly or on the side, right? That has to be the priority of our life. Our life has to reflect that as well. We had the exercise last time about the idea of where did the thought go? Oh, if you stop believing in God tomorrow, would your life look any different? Good question. Okay, I think so. That's pretty good. If life is a river, then pursuing Christ requires swimming upstream. When we stop swimming or actively following Him, we automatically begin to swim downstream. So the idea of S with the leaves here. We all have a river works, right? You've seen a river before? Fish fill up it. Yes, swim real hard. An escalator is a good side thought here. It's a river. You've all seen it. So it's a pretty good idea. That's kind of ties into the idea we had before. Yes, it's all individual. Make sure that you are doing what is right. But the people that are around you have an impact, right? So we just kind of get complacent and get comfortable, and we have a routine that feels good enough. That can be a problem if we don't pay attention to it. Okay. I believe that much of the American church-going population, while not specifically swimming downstream, is slowly floating away from Christ. It isn't a conscious choice, but is nonetheless happening because little in their life propels them toward Christ. So that's changed perspective. And we talked about his story before. He was going to a church, wasn't happy with it, so he started a little house church, and that grew into a five 1,000-member congregation or church in California. And then that got too big for him, and he felt like he was getting kind of swept into this mega church pastor lifestyle. Quit that, began a small house church project, and then now he sold everything and he's preaching in the East. So that's Francis Chan's. That's kind of his catalyst to make all those decisions and what's his experience in these churches. Questions, comments? We have one more thing to talk about. Do you feel like his assessment is accurate about the general American churchgoing experience being insufficient when it comes to God's standards?
Yes.
I don't think that accurate because I don't think that he's not a Christian in my opinion. He's told us we're not Christian, but if somebody goes to tell him he's not going to heaven, how do you think he's going to respond?
Do you think he's not going to heaven?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think makes chain laws?
I don't see where he was asked enough to be totally committed, totally giving God the very best. I don't see where he is.
Do you have a book?
Huh?
Do you have a book?
No.
Did you read it?
No, like I said, I don't want to support his hat.
okay.
But you know, because you, before we started this class, you said he's not a Christian. You said you had issues with what he teaches and what he believes.
Yeah.
So he's out there teaching falsehood.
Yeah.
He's just like people from the original first, the early Christian church.
Okay. Well, I'm not convinced that he is not a Christian in the sense that he teaches the truth about the idea of salvation. I believe his worship style is unbiblical, unscriptural, but he teaches, I think, the truth on that.
They that worship me must worship in spirit and in truth.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other thing, right? When it comes to getting out of the gate, if he teaches the truth about baptism,
still, in the old law, if you were guilty in one point, you were guilty in all of it.
Right.
Right. In Christianity, I feel the same way.
Yeah.
If you're guilty in one point, if I did that there with a tuba, play to God,
okay,
then I'm condemned because I failed on one point, but all of the ways because it's not being
explained. Okay, let's back to the original question. All right, we're getting bogged down a little bit. The original question was, do you think his assessment is accurate about the average American church-going experience?
Yes, but that's the wrong question to ask in the first place, because nobody's church-going experience is ever going to get them to heaven. It's how you live outside of here that makes that difference.
Yeah, that's true. It is more than just the church-going experience, right? But he's saying that their lives do not reflect what they express in the worship service, per se, right? The point of why I wanted to ask that was because he's trying to say, I think in chapter 5, give God your best. Right? That's his whole point. Don't get any leftovers. If that's true, then what has he done to do that? Well, I just told you, quit his mega church, start small churches, and then gave everything up and went to go preach in the East where there was more souls willing to hear him. But there is that balance. There's the balance of the guilt trip of not doing well enough. And then there's the freedom in Christ. And here is where I ask Eric, if he can recall, the question he asked me 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, so especially when we get to the last chapter, or the last paragraph of this chapter, and he's between this chapter and chapter 4, where he's talking about how hard it is to really follow Christ, and how hard it is to really give him your best and have the kind of heart that he needs you to have. I'm like, wait a minute, whoa, hold up, because In Matthew 11:30, he says, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And the last two chapters of this book keep talking about how heavy it is and how hard it is.
Yeah, there is that balance. That's why I wouldn't bring that out, because that shows the contrast. So you have this whole, we're not doing well enough, this hard life, and you look at it, that's kind of chain soapbox right now. And then you have what he just said from Matthew chapter 11, verse 30, right? Let's go there together. Verse 25, At that time, this is the ESV. At that time, Jesus declared, I thank you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and understanding and revealed them to little children. Yes, Father, for such was your gracious will. He's saying people that only wanted to hear it, they heard it. All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. So Christ reveals the Father too. Verse 28. Here's the invitation. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. So what's the previous state or state of this individual? They work, they labor, and they're heavy laden. What does that mean?
They're struggling.
Struggling, okay. What's the literal word picture is literally someone carrying a heavy load, right? Something about carrying a backpack all day, it's burdened down. That's kind of the idea here. Take my yoke upon you. Now, what's a yoke?
Like burden. Thing to put around an ox to keep them
raised. Yeah, what's a yoke?
Ties two oxen together.
Okay, so you got oxen back in the day, right? Yeah. Or horses.
Joints together the neck.
You put it around their neck, and they are going to be pulling something that's heavy, right? Usually together. So yoke fellow, we're working together for this cause. So he's saying, come to me, I will give you rest. And then I'll put a yoke on you, which is usually not very restful, right? And learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. And here's the key, I think, verse 30. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. So it's saying, you've been by yourself, pulling this heavy load.
I think that's, to some degree, means the law.
Okay, context is key there. You're right about that. But overall, the point is, you've been carrying this heavy burden by yourself. Come to me. We'll work together, you and me, it to be a lighter load to carry. You're still a load to carry?
Yes.
Seems like it. But it's going to be a lot lighter with Christ. Ready?
I just think when I have had problems and I turn them over to God, that's lifted right off.
Yeah.
I feel that lifted off, and now I think that's what he's doing.
Okay. So yeah, this is Jesus talking, right? That's what they're looking for you. I think what Eric has brought up here is a very good key. The balance between being a true disciple is hard work versus the rest that we get from Christ is somewhere in between. Right?
You always have him to turn to.
Yeah. You're learning from him.
By the time you get to the end of chapter 5, though, you're like, boy, the burden doesn't seem so light.
Yeah, that's the thing about this book is, that's why I've tried to set it up to be, make sure you don't go ahead. Because
which I kind of
read the book like, this is, being a Christian is not even worth it. Just give up and quit the church. That's not what
the point is. You've got to get past his attitude.
Yeah, I guess.
To be fair, though, I was out of town and I thought I was keeping up.
Yeah, well, we slowed down in chapter 4. So, okay, any more thoughts, comments? Chapter 6 next week, it gets better, folks. Telling you, chapter 4 is the roughest one. It's a little bit better. And the very last chapter, I think, is the best one. So, okay, thanks so much for your attention and time. We'll be dismissed now about 15 minutes before we